Welcome to Speak to It, a show run by peers with lived experience of mental illness and substance use in Niagara. We're here to create a dialogue, celebrate journeys, and bridge communities. Today's episode focuses on the topic of voting, why it matters, some of the barriers voters face, and reasons why some folks might feel disenfranchised over this hard-earned right. When Canada was first formed in 1867, only men of 21 years or older and who owned property could vote in federal elections. In 1876, the Indian Act finally granted First Nation peoples the right to vote, but only if they gave up their status. In 1917, during World War I, both men and women serving in the armed forces were offered the right to vote, including some First Nations peoples and Asian Canadians. Women did not earn the full right to vote until the next year, as long as they met the same eligibility criteria as men. In 1948, all Asian Canadians finally gained the right to vote after many folks lost their lives building the Canadian Pacific Railway. By 1960, all First Nations men and women could vote without having to give up their status and despite where they lived. By 1982, the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms affirmed the right of every Canadian citizen to vote or run an election. I spoke with local social activist Carrie Duncan and asked them what they would say to people who choose not to vote or who feel it doesn't make a difference. Many people don't vote because they believe there is no point. You'll hear things such as, all politicians are the same, they're only concerned about power or making things better for their wealthy friends, or they have no genuine concern for those who are suffering. Another question is, my vote won't make a real difference, so what's the point in voting anyway? What would you say to those people?
Thanks for the question. There's a lawyer I follow online who lives in the U.S., and her name's Elizabeth Booker Houston, and she shared the perspective that whether you choose to vote or not vote, there's unintended consequences for everyone. So no matter your action in this situation, no matter your choice and how you choose to pursue it, there will be an unintended consequence. And I really like that perspective because it moves it away from the personality politics and the people to the action and to the impact and the in-between space. Voting is a singular action devoted to an election where certain personalities get brought to the forefront. And rarely does that actually characterize what political engagement looks like. And so when people ask what the point is, I think that's a very justified question because they're being told to look at the election. They're being told to look at the action of voting and likely having all the political work they do in the in-between discredited in that moment. And so when people are asking those questions, I think we often have politicians or political parties pointing to voting as a solution, a solitary solution. And even the questioning becomes like the antagonist to solving a problem. And really what they're doing is distracting from what's important to that person, which is how will change happen in the in-between? Change won't happen the day someone's elected. Sometimes people don't come to office the day they're elected. And yet we're fed a narrative that voting happens in a single moment. It happens in a single choice for a single party who have a certain set of perspectives that don't necessarily represent everyone. And so when people bring up these points, the thing to always remember is it will have an unintended consequence for someone, whether you choose to vote or not vote. Both of those things, something will happen. And so it's better to maybe reframe it of like, what if you do choose to vote, what is that paired with in your life in terms of participation? Do you know how to read a political budget? Are you interested in reading the political budget? Do you know what decisions got made in the in-between? Because really, political things that happen don't happen in accordance with the election. They happen in the 4 years in between. And often when people are questioning the purpose of voting, they're actually speaking to a much more important discussion, which is disengagement in the in-between. People not having the opportunity to speak up or not being listened to. And also not really wanting to associate with a single personality. I don't know that I want to become the best friends of every person I ever voted for. In fact, I know I don't. However, and you know, like I think about a lot of people who have a lot of different interests. They have a lot of different reasons for voting for people. But what they want to know is how will those politicians follow up with them if they do get elected? How will they follow up with them if they don't get elected? And I think it's really important that people be allowed to ask those questions without such severe shame or like political moral blaming on them, because really what they're doing in asking that is asking how to engage beyond the election, how to engage in ways that maybe feel more representative of their needs.
Can you speak a bit to the limitations of the voting system, especially for those who are most impacted by it, such as disabled folks, incarcerated folks, migrant workers, non-citizens, etc.?
So within my personal experience, I have a brother who has developmental disabilities, and my partner is not a citizen. And one person is allowed to vote, who's my brother, but cannot read the ballot himself. And one person is not allowed to vote, but politically engages all the time. And these are two people who are living in a lot of privilege, and in terms of like infringement voting law, for all intents and purposes, they have the rights to vote and there are mechanisms. But there's a lot of ways that they're just cut out. So when we look at migrant workers, there's a huge movement for permanent status on arrival. This would give people the ability to vote on issues and for politicians who are making laws about their living conditions. And with especially consistent reports coming out of the Migrant Rights Network, migrant workers need the ability to vote. When we look at disabled folks, several people will engage. My brother's a very politically engaged person, but he needs support reading his ballot. And when we look at this at a federal or provincial level, it actually kind of, we've come up with a system where there's a color system. So people who are visual readers but can't necessarily read English have a way to associate values with color. We get to the municipal level, there is no color-coded system. And I'm not necessarily calling on people to make a color-coding system right now, but to just reimagine how we think about who wants to be politically involved, who wants to be able to not only vote, but participate in rallies or participate in delegating. But like, I don't think my brother is ever going to delegate to city council, but he has a lot to say. And so one way he practices that is by voting, but he needs that support. And then when we think about, like, especially people with developmental disabilities, they're often looked down upon as not as intelligent or not as politically engaged. So when they bring that to their peers or their support workers, folks don't always know what to do with that. And then often disability services are so dependent on staying, quote unquote, apolitical and basically not questioning. Even just in the last election, we saw ODSP, the increase to ODSP, come on a platform for the first time in so long. And to me, that was more of a political stance than whether that actually got increased or not, because people have been fighting for years for that to get on a platform. Maybe one day it'll go up. But then when we look at people like my partner, or like migrant workers or international students or refugees, so many of our neighbors are just immediately denied the ability to be represented. And yet they're talked about by politicians all the livelong day. And so you really have to wonder, who are we serving? Who, like, if a law is being voted on that someone who it's impacting can't vote, how are they supposed to feel represented in this government? And then you look at the systemic exclusion. So when we look at folks who are incarcerated, some kind of decision by the government kept them from the ability to vote. In some cases, and we can look at the U.S. right now, there are people incarcerated in Florida who are facing terrible situations with weather conditions, and they are trapped in a building with politicians saying they have to be left there. Or we have people who are being sentenced to the death sentence. Politicians chose that. And people like appointed, like the Supreme Court in the U.S., chose that. And yet none of those people got the right to do that one solitary political action. However, they are continually politically engaged. These are some of the most politically engaged people and groups I've ever had the privilege of learning about or working with are people who are advocating for their rights and demanding change happen. And we see this a lot with hunger strikes. We see this a lot with like demanding better health conditions in COVID. The policies of COVID were set by those people elected. And so it's very clear there's such a disconnect between the electoral system and the people who have the ability to participate and those who they are talking about. And I mean, I once had a politician say to me the best thing I could do was get people to volunteer for elections, which was not my favorite situation I've ever been in. And to me, it is such a disconnected and frustrating moment because people were at a political event. They were at an event demanding labor rights and a celebration of labor rights. And yet participating in getting people to come out for an event everyone knows happens was somehow put above, even though that the people I work with, many of them can't vote. What am I supposed to tell my international student volunteer? Like, go volunteer for a person who you can't have an opinion around? That just doesn't make sense. So I think, similar to the last question, reframing things around how are we politically engaged beyond this solitary action as the only opportunity for change. We don't need to disregard all the labor that happens in the in-between. We don't need to pretend there are laws and empowerment that does not exist. However, we can change it. We can move away from saying that voting is the only option for folks, because we just all know that's not true. And we also need to give credit where credit's due to all those folks who can't vote and are doing everything they can to make where we live in Niagara or the country of Canada or like countries they're from and all their different relationships better. Like, they're doing that work every day. And so I would really welcome people who choose to prioritize voting, and especially those being elected or putting their names on the ballot, to really rethink when they're demanding labor, how they engage with communities who aren't allowed to vote and aren't or do vote, people like my brother, but they are very unlikely to talk to in the in-between, and consider how that would change their policy decisions.
So you work for Oberg Brock. Can you speak a little bit about the policies against promoting or affiliating with any political parties?
Yeah, I've never heard it read back to me. That's so interesting. So I work at Oberg, the Ontario Public Interest Research Group, and I work at the Niagara-based chapter, which is Brock. And several years ago, there was a commitment by the Ontario PIRG network to not endorse any political party. This is not an endorsement to vote or not to vote. I think people across the province will make the choices they need to. However, affiliating with a political party just could not meet all of the needs across the OPIRG network. We are 11 chapters, which is just in Ontario, doesn't even count across Canada, who all have different students who are our members and have different needs and demands. We will always speak out against a government that actively harms its people. We will also, though, speak out when people like Sarah Jama are pushed out of their own party and the people she represents are no longer allowed to be represented because she speaks to Palestinian solidarity efforts and the importance of that. And so the issue with affiliating with a party is what happens if that party can't agree to the politics that you hold as an organization. And so because OPIRG is social justice, economic justice, environmental justice, we need to be committed to issues ongoing. And that one party can't always represent that. There might be people who are running in certain parties that we individually or personally support, our family members support. However, as a network, it truly, I think, undercuts some of the activism, how we politically engage in the in-between. I mean, we have several groups we work with who are politically engaged with electoral officials on the regular. And so we hear a lot from politicians and we hear a lot from parties, but not always in a way that we want to see ongoing engagement. We also struggle in the moments where politicians, whether they're affiliated with a party or it's municipal or anything, show up in opportunistic ways, and they like to take photos with activists doing activist work. And that sometimes is really welcomed by groups in the region. Sometimes it's really good funding or political clout. And I don't want to deny those groups the need for that. However, we also don't want to be used in political advertising to portray a politician as being more credible than they are. And especially when we've had politicians be really in line with us in some values and some issues and then very much waver in other ways and actively deny our community members the ability to engage. So I think the reason there are policies there is it prevents co-optation by political parties. It prevents being used by political parties, and it also allows for more voices to come to the table. There aren't just four political parties. And so we have people who are affiliated with many more, and we also have people who can't vote, who are part of our organization. And it really does speak to the need to not be apolitical or not be nonpartisan, but rather be committed to knowing who's doing what on what. And as an organization, we need to be on the ball in terms of if a party or a politician is going to affiliate with a certain perspective, that might really help us and it might really hurt us. So we need to be knowing everything that's going on. And I think that's the other piece, is just a lot of political parties and politicians have very different perspectives on what they would like to see happen. And if any number of those people get elected, it can have a consequence for us. And so we need to be aware of every different piece going on.
Can you talk a bit about the importance of using additional tactics like civic engagement education?
Definitely. So it would be wonderful to see ongoing drop-in spaces where people could learn how to engage in electoral politics in addition to voting. We get so many instructions and so many directions to vote, and we know how to address it if we don't get our voter cards. We know if you can read and also open your emails, if you can read English, that is. However, there's so many things that happen in the in-between between elections. And so whether it's understanding the regional budget, whether it's understanding bylaws and the ability to delegate, whether it's participating in the library public survey that happened recently, there are so many tools for people to understand how, without running for an elected position, they can participate. Also in a way that's not exploitative. We often see advisory councils where people have to apply and be deemed qualified or deemed good enough or reliable enough. And those are unpaid positions. And that's what gets sent to us to advertise. And we really struggle with that because I don't want people doing unpaid labor for politicians. And also I know people do want to know about those opportunities so they can make choices for themselves. And so it would be hugely beneficial in Niagara to have, like across all 12 municipalities, to have drop-in spaces where folks can learn how they can participate. So it's not solely reliant on the one moment, an urgent moment where you have to react, or it's not reliant on being a homeowner. Often we do see a lot of policy around being a homeowner, even though we know we have such a high renter population and a unhoused population. And it also allows for greater accessibility. I can tell you, my brother's not going to delegate to city council. He's not going to be able to write an email to an MPP. However, he will show up at a rally, and that should be counted as participation. He will show up to a community art project and participate because it's engagement. And so really reimagining what it means to, as an elected official or someone who works with elected officials, to create space for people to share their perspectives outside of just the electoral system. And I think a huge part of that's education. Like people we've seen in other cities, when people can start to have drop-ins on the budgets, budgets change. The more voices, the better. And so we need to move away from the dependence on elections and the exclusivity of voting towards a system in which people can know how they could write an opinion piece to the newspaper. People could know how to get their neighbors to Zoom in if maybe they don't have a computer, if they want to speak to something that's happening in their neighborhood. Or if someone has a family emergency come up and they are scheduled to delegate or participate civically, what happens if they have to cancel? Do they lose those opportunities? And so there's a lot of questions I find around what it means to be politically engaged. And there are not that many groups providing those answers. So I would warmly welcome any opportunity to like work with folks who are holding that space to not necessarily, I mean, I obviously have strong political stances on many topics, but even the ability to have access to information is fundamental and essential. And people will make their own choices with how they want to use that information, but it is an active disservice to our community to not have ongoing tools teaching people how they can engage. This is a learned skill. We weren't born with the skill of participating in municipal, provincial, or federal government. It's something we have to learn. And so I would be so excited to know that people are committed to doing that work. And I think people are within their families and their friend groups and their social circles. But whether it was a drop-in at a coffee shop or an event that was hosted quarterly, there just could be great opportunity as long as the questions were welcomed, the skills were shared, and people weren't shamed out the door for not understanding or being frustrated. I think we could see a huge positive influence in our community.
Following up from that, how can those with limited resources engage effectively if they would like to vote?
That's a good question. It depends on what the resource is. So if people would like to choose to vote, I think part of it is firstly learning who you're voting for and what you're voting on. We don't get great opportunity to vote in referendum in Ontario, maybe Canada, which would be great, but it would be great to see more initiative by those trying to get people out to vote to account for folks who have limited resources. Often the onus gets put on people to self-educate, which I understand why you can't talk to everyone, you know. However, it's not their fault if they have limited resources and yet somehow they're blamed for not showing up on voting day. What happens if they work or their car breaks down? I think there is an immediate shame if you're like, no, I missed voting, you know, and it's truly unfair because you don't necessarily know why that person made that choice or had to make that choice that day. And so I think there are things like early voting that inherently helped, and also just expanding where spaces are. Often they're in community centers, which is great, but is there transit to that community center? And is there a map to the door? People might be like, well, it's common sense and the yellow signs are everywhere. However, some people might need more support getting there. Also, if you're, say, a parent or a caregiver and you have your people with you that you're caring for, you have not that many minutes in the moment. And so accounting for, like, some folks can't stand in line for hours at a time. And I think they do try in terms of time accessibility, but are they paying for that bus fare? Probably not. Should buses be free on voting days? That could be a potential option. This would go to the Regional Transit Commission to have a discussion. And then also realizing that the internet is not a completely accessible resource across the board. And that is what we are heavily relying on for people to self-educate. There are many politicians and groups who will have town halls and obviously public debates. And there was voting before computers existed and internet. And yet those tactics are not relied on as heavily. I think in some ways they're trying to appeal to a younger base, which I think is great. Like, you do want to hear what young people are saying. But again, who are you missing? You're often missing older populations who are debatably the most politically engaged, but they rarely get the opportunity to learn about a new person. And so then we see a reoccurring cycle where folks will vote for the same person they know. There's a level of comfort, and I can understand that. But maybe there's someone they're more politically aligned with, but that person's solely relying on the internet. I'm from a town of 2,500 people, and those folks care about the environment, and they care about keeping nature spaces protected, and they vote for politicians who do not support that because that's who they know. Farmers vote with farmers, and I don't blame them. I actually blame the folks who look down upon them for voting for who they know. Maybe people should go get to know them. And then also, I think more emphasis really needs to be put on translation. I understand we're a French-English bilingual country, and we talk about that as an essential piece. And also, we have many people who live in Niagara and in this country who do not, that is not their first language. And so, whether they're disabled or they're a newcomer or just a non-English speaker, they're already working harder than everyone else to participate in that space and be accepted in that space. And so the least you could do is have the ballot translated into a language that they can speak and read with ease, and giving them the most mental processing time. And in terms of resources, there are resources to translate it into Arabic, into Mandarin, into Japanese, into any number of languages. And so I don't really understand why we don't choose that, but we know from newcomers in the area and various studies, translated resources do a wealth of good of getting whole families out to participate. And so a lot of this takes a lot of work and takes a lot more planning than I think ever goes into elections, because people tend to have a standardized equation or recipe for how an election shall take place. And it's reliant on funding or social events. And rarely is it involved planning. in terms of who's not showing up and asking why and actually changing it. We do get a lot of questions of why don't people show up. And when we answer, they're like, oh, yeah, that's horrible. And rarely are they like, okay, we understand we will not fix that this time and we will immediately start working towards that. It is not hard to hire translators in this country or like creating pictograph. These are ways we can reimagine who is not showing up and why. And maybe they still won't show up for other reasons. They're allowed to, but maybe they will because they'll feel represented or they'll feel comfortable or they'll feel able. I think it's important to think about what's considered respectable political action and what's not. There's a lot of clout or credibility given to voting and politicians who often wear suits and often own their homes and often fit a certain model. And that isn't to say all politicians fit that model. I think there's a lot of people working very hard to change that. But when we think about respectability politics, voting is deemed a respectable form of activism for some. And often this does not include folks who are deemed criminal or messy or unhelpful or argumentative or disagreeable. And what they're actually saying is there's only certain types of people who should be allowed to elect people to run our society. And often this excludes substance users and folks who use substances. This excludes unhoused folks who are having their items stolen on a daily basis. So that might include their voting information. And those are the folks we want to be voicing their opinion. Those are the folks we have to have because they're dying and they have the right to call for change or not. They have the right to survive. And so when we put a moral superiority on voting and we look down upon folks who are not, it really doesn't help us. And then when we also shame people for voting because we feel like it might not change, it also likely might not help us. I think there is an argument to be made about changing people's perspective to broaden, to think about why people do choose to vote or not choose to vote. But when we look at the frustration, really what that system is doing is having us target each other opposed to target the politicians and target this inaccessible system. And I don't want to fight my neighbors. I really want to work with them. And it always has to be a challenge to those in elected positions to think about they have the ability to vote. They have the ability to fit the model. And they have a responsibility to talk to those who do not. The best activist I've ever met in Niagara passed away this year. And she was the most vocal person I'd ever met advocating for mutual aid. There's no person who I met more often asking me for free store. Crystal, who is a neighbor of many of us downtown, a good friend of mine. And she is one of the best political activists I've ever met. But she doesn't get talked about that way because she didn't delegate to City Hall. I don't know if she ever voted, honestly. But what a politically engaged heart that truly, I think, did change the political atmosphere. She would come to the free store and work all a shift at the free store and then take things to various communities, various encampments, because they needed things. And yet we have politicians saying we don't have the right to give people things and that we are creating trash. And effectively what they're saying is people thriving is trash, and that's harmful. That results in our people dying. And when I think about people like Crystal, I feel motivated and I feel ready to take on people who tell me voting is the only option. Because it's so clearly not. She changed how we do free stores and how I think about free stores. And my board, the OPERC board, is elected by our membership. Same process, 200 plus members, you know. And they are required to listen to people like Crystal. And it changes our programming based on what our members are saying. And so I really hope that people think about activists in a way that is politically engaged and is about community building, and that voting is one tactic amongst so many to build up safety and also prevent harm. It can be faceless or a popularity contest. It can be reliant on who can raise the most money from people who don't live here. And so rarely is it based on the anecdotes and the one-on-ones and the stories of Niagara which is where I really think it should be rooted out of. I want to know the reasons why people advocated for amalgamated transit. We want to know the reasons. We want to do everything possible to remove barriers to people being in our community and surviving in our community and ideally thriving. And so I would really encourage folks to think about the people they know and the people they love and how, whether they choose to vote or not vote, what types of potential unexpected consequences might happen, and make those choices for them. And then also make those choices in not just a four-year cycle. These problems were not caused in a four-year cycle. I don't really know why politicians believe it'll be solved in a four-year cycle, but let's play the long game here. Voting is one tactic in a lifetime of living, and people bring so much to this community and so much to this world, and I truly hope that they feel encouraged and engaged in all of the different ways that motivate them, which may or may not include voting.
Thank you for speaking with us, Carrie.
Thank you, Allison. We took a quick survey and asked people about their voting habits.
I feel it's my duty as a citizen to vote. I feel we have a responsibility to say what we feel as far as our government is concerned. So I always vote. We have to have our input into what we want the government to do for us. I would say that it's important to vote, to be heard. I don't feel it's a waste of time, even when things don't turn out the way we would like them to. But it's still important to have your voice heard. It's important to vote, especially when you think bad things may happen. I think we can't control the outcome always, but it's important that we say what we need to say, regardless of the outcome. We can do other things that will help move things along, being involved in things like volunteer work or maybe working for a political party for a while. There's lots of things we can do that can help change the face of government. Certainly in the U.S., there's a lot of people who are disenfranchised from voting. The lower class people often don't have a voice in what happens. People who are minorities often don't vote. But when it counts, you see people come out in huge numbers to try and prevent a negative outcome.
When I was 18, one of the first things I did to establish independence as an adult was to go out and vote in the election for that year. I had brought it up to my mom, and she told me that I was not allowed to go vote after school, and I decided to go anyways, and I lied and said that the bus wasn't working, and I went to go vote, and I voted, and felt very proud of myself that I had fulfilled that responsibility. And actually, a few years later, she had brought it up to me that she had regretted not voting in that election, thinking that I had also not voted in that election. And at that point, I told her that actually I did go and vote anyways. And we had a further conversation around the idea of voting, but every election I've been able to vote in, I have, because I think it's a responsibility as a Canadian to go and do that, and to not only do that, but be informed on the platforms and be well informed while doing that as well.
I don't really vote because at the current climate, both parties aren't really beneficial to people trying to live their life. I believe that there's no good side to politics, that either way you vote, there's going to be stuff you like, and then there's going to be stuff that ruin a lot of people's lives and makes living harder for people.
Well, I think in terms of consequences, to boil it down to a simple binary of voting or not voting, I think that assumes that everyone has a level playing field and everyone has equal access to the democratic process in Canada, which is to vote. So people who are unhoused, people who don't have quote-unquote proper identification, it's really challenging. There are a lot of barriers that exist that keep people from having their say, which is their right as Canadians.
I think years ago, it probably was in the best interest to vote, but in this time and age, no, because I believe the rich put their politicians in where they want them, and money talks, and it's not good for the good of the people. It's to help them to get richer and richer. I think voting is a waste of your time, your energy. I believe in your heart, you need to keep the hope, but if you so choose for yourself to vote, then so be it. But for me, nope, I won't vote. I will stand with brothers and sisters that want to lift each other up and help one another, because the government was supposed to be made for the people. And we need good people in to help us be who we are and grow and thrive. And it's not working the government way.
I've always been a regular voter. I used to support the same party for years because I believed in what they represented. And I felt they followed through with big issues from their platform. However, that's since changed. And I found myself voting for the party that was the lesser of all evils. I find that the politicians usually don't follow through on issues once elected, so I have a hard time trusting in them. That being said, I believe it's important to vote because it is empowering to me. I have a choice as to who will represent me at the municipal, provincial, and federal levels. Even if the party I voted for doesn't get elected, at least I can say I've done all that I can do.
To anybody who does not want to vote, I accept you all. No matter we live in two different worlds, just always live life and surrounding that accepts you and just be yourself.
Thank you, Andrew. In our next segment, Valerie spoke with Desmond Sequeira about voting and community engagement. Desmond is active in climate action and the movement for justice in Palestine, Israel. We asked him if he chooses to vote.
I do. It's the least I can do to affect the direction of the city, the province, and the country, and eventually, I guess, through that, the world, in whatever small way I can.
What would your ideal candidate look like?
I tend to concentrate a lot more on the provincial and the federal level. And my ideal candidate does not exist, because for me, the ideal candidate, if we're talking in terms of democracy being of the people, by the people, and for the people, I don't think we, properly speaking, do have a democracy in Canada or in Ontario for that matter. But basically, what our present system consists of, okay, I go and vote, as you say, and somebody gets my vote. But then after that, I have absolutely no say in the matter of what happens in government, actually. And so therefore, basically, I feel a little bit used at this point.
How often have you seen information on parties that you didn't search for yourself that wasn't a smear campaign?
I see a lot of information put out by different parties, which are not necessarily smear information at all. They obviously say all kinds of wonderful things that they're going to do for the province or the country or whatever. A lot of it is good information. A lot of it may make sense to me, and then some of it does not. I see information, and it's not necessarily mostly smear.
Politicians themselves, meaninglessness and apathy and lack of interest are the three main reasons people don't vote in Canada. From your perspective, what could improve this?
For one thing, the people, the ordinary Canadians, need to have an ongoing effect on the government of Canada. And therefore, I think there needs to be an ongoing consultation between elections. Because people in Canada or anywhere says, oh, you've elected your government, now you just take what they give you. And the answer is, no, we didn't elect them to take what they give us. We elected them to do what we want them to do, and therefore they need to ask us at every stage of the process what we actually want. And they cannot sort of say, oh, the only time you're going to get a chance to say something different is by voting again 4 years from now. That does not make sense. One of the ways that is getting a lot of momentum now is what is called citizens' assemblies, where the process is ongoing, and at every stage of the process, citizens are assembled to discuss important issues and then instruct the person whom they have elected to do what they want, not what the party leadership wants, and whereby the so-called backbenchers mostly sort of fall in line because somebody in the head of the party said, this is how we're going to do it. But then that completely disregards the idea of government for the people, by the people, and of the people, especially the of the people part.
I want to get a little bit into disenfranchised and marginalized folks and the effect they could have on voting. Mostly that portion of the population doesn't vote, and arguably they're one of the most vulnerable portions of the population, and their voice needs to be heard in order to affect some positive change for them. So is it important for politicians to hear from disenfranchised and marginalized folks and to consider what they're saying seriously?
Absolutely. In the current way modern politics is run in governments, etc., the only people who seem to be not disenfranchised are the people who are the economic brokers of power. And a lot of times it's the whole idea of money counts and everything is geared to money, which is terrible. In fact, for example, you can't even form a political party until you have a certain amount of money, which is a ridiculous thing. What about the people who can't get the money to form the party? Things like that, you know? So that's why I think it's terribly important that every segment of society that feels it's disenfranchised needs to come together with other segments who may also feel disenfranchised and then form a unity, what you can call a coalition, of disenfranchised people. And then you become a little bit more franchised.
How would current policy be different if politicians did listen to those folks?
You mean if they actually consider the joint voices of disenfranchised groups? Well, that might be heaven. It's a nice thought. Mind you, it's a thought that we are all fighting for. The whole idea of justice and everything we do is precisely that. We are actually trying to promote right now what we are calling a coalition for common concerns. And that is basically telling people, like, for example, if you have belonged to an organization which has bottom lines, this is what we want. And I belong to an organization that has a bottom line and says, this is what we want. Now, can you support what I want? And can I support what you want? If we can, you and I have a coalition. Your organization and my organization has a coalition. Then we get Deborah's organization to come in and we get a third. And that way, whoever can support each other's bottom lines, then we say to whoever wants to claim to be representing us in government, hold on, these are our bottom lines. Are you prepared to go to Parliament, for example, and insist on these bottom lines and don't just keep quiet because your party leader told you to shut up? My socialism is pretty radical in the sense of, do we all live in the same kind of house? Do we all eat the same kind of food? Are we all going to be having the same kind of transportation? For me, that's what socialism is. And I'm coming from a background that people who are committed to Jesus Christ, that was Jesus' message. Whoever has two tunics, you give one to the person who does not have. Are we prepared to do that? And then people, not quite, because different people have different needs and this. And I said, that's very nice. So that's not socialist enough for me. Because if you're starting to do, then you sort of say, okay, I need this kind of special house because I have these so-called needs. I'm coming from that sort of background. I don't like to call it a Christian background anymore because unfortunately, I think a lot of Christians have actually lost the message of Jesus.
How can we make voting more accessible?
We have a thing called respecting people's their rights to do whatever they want as long as it's not being criminal of some form. So you can't force people to vote, but we can certainly encourage them. Education, obviously, but it has to be done in an accelerated and accentuated way so that people actually begin to understand that every vote counts. But again, just that one vote at that time is not good enough. That needs to be preceded. To make voting accessible, we have what is called citizens' assemblies so that disenfranchised people, the people whom I see every day, it is so bad to see on the streets of St. Catharines, which is shocking because this is supposed to be a first world country. They should be part of the citizens' assemblies. So all the disenfranchised people should be included so that they can firsthand indicate what they want and what they want us to vote for. And then they become part of that voting process by along with us. And that way they begin to feel some credibility that their vote actually counts because they are part of what I would like to call a coalition.
What do you think are the biggest barriers for folks voting?
Credibility, mostly, because if I believed that my vote was meaningful and actually counted, then I would vote. Nowadays, I actually do vote, but I'm not too sure what my vote is worth. Right. So even though I believe I'm actually vote, So a lot of people don't vote because, again, they've said it often directly to me, oh, it's no use because the politicians will just do whatever they want anyway. Mm-hmm. So what's the point in bothering to vote? But I think the voting will be effective if it is preceded, and I would emphasize this, by citizens' assemblies or coalitions for common concerns. These are important things to precede going to the polling booth. And then, of course, the big question is that this first past the post is just not any more valid and good enough. I think that that's terribly important. It needs to be proportional representation. So you don't have a party that wins maybe 30% or 35% of the vote, then having the only say in government, which includes 70% of the other people. These are symptoms. In fact, Trump is a symptom. He's not the disease. And I think the disease is that culturally, we have made people, I would think, feel that they don't really count. And if as a society we reverse that by means of citizens' assemblies, by means of coalitions for common concerns, because the people who are in power are not going to do anything to change that. They're going to keep that because they're in power. And if they're not top, they'll be second, but they're still in power. It's sad that people don't vote, but they would if they were, first of all, included in community in the first place. And that is terribly important, I think, in order to initiate grassroots activism, bringing citizens assemble. Not politicians assemble, not parliament sits when it wants to and unsits when it doesn't want to. That would be key, I think, citizens assemblies.
Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show. Thank you to Carrie Duncan, Desmond Sequeira, and our crew, Valerie, Kimberly, Andrea, Allison, Mikkel, James, Andrew, Deb, and Lee. Thanks for listening.
This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada.